I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we're going to be doing an episode that's part of a series that we're doing for America 250, returning back to founding debates, founding principles, founding documents to help us understand their meaning, not only for our founding period, but also what they mean, have meant through American history and what they mean today for today. Today, we're going to be focusing on, of course, one of the most famous, maybe the most famous work of American political science, The Federalist. And we're going to be talking particularly about the important, great, noteworthy, really essential contribution of Alexander Hamilton to The Federalist. And I'm joined for that conversation by an old friend, a personal friend of mine, but also, of course, a great friend of the Ashbrook Center and, of course, of this podcast. Many of our listeners have heard Steve with us here before on The American Idea. Professor Steve Knott is the Thomas and Mabel Guy Chair in American History and Government at Ashland University. He is also, of course, Professor Emeritus at the Naval War College. Before the Naval War College, many of you know, Steve was co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Program at the wonderful Miller Center at the University of Virginia, where he did very important work in the history of American presidency. He teaches courses in the master's program here at Ashland University on the presidency, George Washington and Alexander Hamilton, a terrific course on those two statesmen, and he's teaching a course on national security and the Constitution. So we have someone whose career and knowledge spans many, many, many decades of study, that is to say, but also, of course, written many important books. I think, Steve, I counted 10 books now that you're the author of.
That's correct, Jeff. And thank you for that warm introduction.
Yeah. And the most recent one that has just come out, which we had Steve on the podcast for an episode, of course, is called Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy. Terrific book, a very poignant book, a combination of the personal and the political in a really beautiful way. And I have it, Steve, that you may be working on a new book.
That is correct, Jeff. It's a look at how various American presidents have chosen to either circulate conspiracy theories or in some instances sort of try to, you know, contain them, not stir the pot. So there's some examples that perhaps are somewhat troublesome, and there are some examples that I think we can hope for to be emulated by our chief executives.
Fascinating. Well, we'll look forward, of course, to that book. But in the meantime, let me recommend to all of our listeners, if you haven't read it already, Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy, terrific book by our guest, Steve Knott. Steve, thanks for being with us on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. And let me just thank you for the important work that you and your center are involved in terms of civics education on so many fronts. And I can't think of anything more important for our republic these days. So, you know, in all honesty, thank you for you and your staff and the great work that they're engaged in.
We appreciate that. Obviously, part of that work is having these kind of conversations that get out to the public, to students, to teachers, to citizens, on the Constitution and its meaning and its importance. Maybe I should start this way. James Madison is called the father of the Constitution. But you have argued, and I think persuasively, that nobody did more for the Constitution than Alexander Hamilton. Maybe we could even call him the interpreter of the Constitution if Madison is the father of the Constitution. Tell us about Hamilton's role originally in organizing what has become known as the Federalist Papers.
Sure. So Hamilton, I think it's important to note, at the Philadelphia Convention, he wasn't necessarily a key player because he was outnumbered 2-1 by his fellow New York delegates who were appointed by Governor George Clinton and who were opposed to any dramatic changes to the existing Articles of Confederation. So Hamilton's impact at the convention itself, I would argue, was somewhat limited. In fact, he grew so frustrated at one point that he actually left for a couple of weeks. And I think George Washington and a few others contacted him and said, you know, would you consider coming back? And the point is that I think Hamilton's greatest contributions in terms of the Constitution and getting it ratified are going to occur after the convention, when he realizes upon returning home to New York State that the odds are stacked against his state, New York, ratifying the convention, the Constitution. And so this is when, probably sometime late September 1787, early October 1787, he decides that he's going to try to write a series of what today we might call op-eds in favor of the proposed Constitution. And he's going to enlist the help of James Madison from Virginia and a fellow New Yorker by the name of John Jay. It's interesting to note, Jeff, he initially went to Gouverneur Morris as well and asked Morris to contribute some of the essays, which would have been fascinating, particularly since Morris, who's often called the penman of the Constitution, was an eloquent writer. He turned down the offer due to some existing obligations. But nonetheless, Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, Hamilton's the driving force behind these documents. Again, in part, he's focused on trying to win ratification in the key state of New York. Of the 85 Federalist essays, Hamilton will write 51, pardon me. Madison will write 29. And John Jay, who will take ill after undertaking the project, will only contribute 5, although they're 5 very interesting essays. But that's how it all starts, Jeff.
Talk a little bit about the original approach that Hamilton wanted to have in terms of conversation with Madison and Jay in producing the essays, and then sort of what happened after that.
Sure. So time was somewhat pressing here, in that the ratification process had already begun. Madison, of course, is down in Virginia. Jay is somewhat nearby in New York. But correspondence, the delays in correspondence being what they were, there were some awkward time lags, I think, that drove Hamilton to distraction, since he was a workaholic. But he is encouraging both of them to contribute. I do think it is accurate to say, and you mentioned this, Jeff, I would agree with the title of Madison being the father of the Constitution. But I do think Hamilton is the father of the Federalist Papers. He's driving that train. He is subtly pushing them, the other contributors, to contribute. And he's the one in Federalist Number 1 who will actually lay out how those forthcoming essays are going to evolve. So the first, I think, number 2 through 14, talk about the utility of the Union to the happiness of the people. And then after number 14 is going to get into some more specifics. Madison in particular will deal with the Congress. And so that's in separation of powers, checks and balances, of course, absolutely vital. Jay will write 5 essays dealing mostly with foreign policy. Hamilton will focus on the presidency and the judiciary. So there is a kind of division of labor, I hope this answers your question, Jeff, that Hamilton construes or lays out right off the bat.
Hamilton was driven to this, as you suggest, by the urgent need for ratification. What was the situation politically like in New York for the Friends of the Constitution?
Yeah, terrific question. The situation, I would argue, was somewhat dire. And the reason for that, again, is I think I mentioned Governor George Clinton of New York, who was perfectly happy with the existing arrangement under these Articles of Confederation. He was doing quite well. He and his political minions, if you will, were somewhat flourishing. And New York was not experiencing some of the same economic dislocations that other parts of the newly independent nation were experiencing. So Clinton, his allies, New York City itself were doing okay. And to argue for a kind of radical change was an uphill battle. So you had a political machine of sorts stacked against ratification. And you had, I think, on the part of a number of members of the public in New York, a sense that why do we need to go down this potentially risky path of, ending a system that seemed to be working fairly well for us. So, again, from my perspective, Hamilton's actions here, both in terms of pulling the Federalist Papers together and leading the charge in the New York Ratification Convention in June and July of 1788, were, this might be an overstatement, but politically heroic, politically risky in that he could have easily lost. And in the end, he triumphed, but in a very, very narrow way.
Where did he get that sense of urgency for the new nation, that he really thought we must have a union and the Constitution must help to cement that union? Why was he so urgent?
Yeah, Jeff, I think it comes primarily from having literally put his life on the line for independence. There were a number of occasions during the Revolutionary War when Hamilton could have been killed. Yorktown, for instance, he led a key charge. He was in the thick of a number of battles in that war, showed, I think, considerable courage. And I think when one has put oneself on the line for a cause during wartime and then sees that cause endangered during peacetime, this is what's going to motivate this man to swing into action. And keep in mind, Jeff, he had a very lucrative law practice in Manhattan. He could have, in the 1780s, he could have easily just said, along with some of the Clinton folks, I'm doing fine. We don't need to change anything. But he was committed to the cause, not just of American independence, but I think he was committed to the cause of creating what he referred to in Federalist Number One as a kind of interesting empire. Now, Hamilton's a guy who envisions the United States in the 1780s becoming an economic and military power. But that's not going to happen under an Articles of Confederation where you have a central government that's completely neutered for the most part, and you have 13 separate states pulling in different directions. So part of it, I'd say the lion's share of Hamilton's motive, Jeff, was a noble one, and one that he shared, by the way, with George Washington, whom he had literally been at Washington's side through the Revolution. And then I would put into the mix as well, Hamilton was a man of great ambition. I think it was a kind of noble ambition, but he wanted to leave a mark that would be remembered 200 or 250 years later by people like us.
Right. And I'm struck by, you referenced the Federalist Number One essay. I'm struck by this wonderful phrase that he has, mm-hmm. which has so much poignancy, really, for our country. And here's what Hamilton says, speaking to the people of the state of New York. He says, "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country to decide, by their conduct and example, the important question whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force." What was so important to Hamilton about this part of the American experiment?
Yeah, terrific question. And I'm with you, Jeff. I love that quote from, I think, the very first paragraph of Federalist One. I love the fact that you've chosen to cite it, because Hamilton is sometimes accused of being, and in comparison to Jefferson, he is less of a child of the Enlightenment. He is less of an idealist. I think there's a tendency at times to see him too much as an engineer, as an architect, concerned about creating institutions that will make us a formidable nation state. And all of that is true, by the way. But I do think there's more to it. If you just focus on that, you're missing the full picture of a man who really did have a deep romantic streak, in a sense, who truly believed, and just before that quote you read, Jeff, he talks about the fate of an empire in many respects, the most interesting in the world. And I do believe he felt we were creating an empire of liberty. That phrase is going to be more associated with Jefferson, perhaps rightly so. But again, it's a mistake to view Jefferson as just a, excuse me, Hamilton as just a kind of cold-hearted realist intent on building financial and military institutions. This was a guy who bought into the broader poetry, if you will, of the American experiment. So thank you for highlighting that. And I hope your audience takes what I've just said and what you've said to heart.
That's interesting to me because he does seem to have been truly a committed small R Republican
Yes.
in a way that perhaps later some of his enemies, of course, pilloried him for betraying the Republican cause. But certainly here in the Federalist Number One, that seems to be a prime motivation for him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would add, Jeff, you're part of the reason for that belief that Hamilton perhaps was not all that taken with Republican government is something he says towards the end of Federalist Number One, where he warns of demagogues undermining Republican government, demagogues who flatter the people and who play on the people's passions and their fears to rise to power, and then once attaining power, will turn against the people. So Hamilton is less enamored than Jefferson and some of his Hamilton's later critics, including, unfortunately, James Madison, who will come to see him as a kind of closet aristocrat, maybe even a closet autocrat. I don't happen to believe that to be the case. The writings here in Federalist Number One are not the words of a closet autocrat. Now, in fairness to his critics, Jeff, as you know, at the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton proposed a president elected for life, subject to impeachment, elected, but elected for life. When that comes out in later years, that's going to further this notion that this guy's got some sort of un-American autocratic tendencies that are more at home with the old world than the new.
All right. What about the argument that then Hamilton proceeds to make? You mentioned in the early essays, there's a focus on the utility of the Union.
Yes.
In those early essays, what's Hamilton arguing for to the people of the state of New York, why we really need this Constitution for the sake of the Union?
Yeah, I would say, well, there's a couple of reasons. First and foremost, Hamilton, of all this, well, other than George Washington, Hamilton is perhaps most concerned about what today we would call national security. Hamilton is a believer in a strong military, a standing army, a standing navy. That sets him apart from Jefferson and Madison, and perhaps the most of the founding generation. But again, that military experience of Hamilton leads him to believe that these 13 separate states, if we don't band together, we're going to be picked apart by our foreign adversaries, whether it's Britain or France or somebody else. And that in union will come strength. And that's going to be a major theme of those early essays of Hamilton, that if we don't take this step, the old world powers will play on our, will play on our differences, try to capitalize on our differences, and lead to the disintegration of the Union if we don't consolidate more, if we don't adopt this newly proposed Constitution. The other aspect, Jeff, is that Hamilton believed that a stronger central government would protect the rights of property, would lead to a more stable, a more law-abiding polity. And the president, in particular, would be charged with taking care that the laws be faithfully executed. The judiciary, the newly proposed judiciary, would also do the same. So Hamilton tries to make the case that property rights and liberty itself will be better protected in a national union resting on this proposed constitution. So he sees the potential for 13 independent states, some of which were in the grips of a kind of populist, shall we say, Shays Rebellion style sentiment, that represented a very threat to the right of property and went right to the heart of the core of what liberty truly means.
So if we've got the first set of arguments there, as you say, for those two reasons, Hamilton outlining the need, the utility of union, as he puts it, and then the next set seems to be, and the insufficiency of the present articles toward that. And I'm struck by a remark that he says, that Hamilton makes, I believe, in Federalist number 15, where he talks about the great radical vice of the Articles of Confederation, which is that the legislative power does not operate directly on individuals. Mm. It operates through the intermediary of the state governments and therefore is not properly what he calls a government, really. Can you tell us a little bit more about the argument, the criticism that Hamilton has of the Articles of Confederation?
Sure, Jeff. So again, I think so much of this stems from Hamilton's wartime experience. Both he and General Washington, later President Washington, will never forget, and I get it, the lack of supplies, the lack of manpower. If you go through the papers of George Washington during the point at which he's the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, constant pleading for just basic supplies that any military, if it's going to be successful, has to rely on. And the states were not delivering. And the Confederation Congress and the initial Continental Congress lacked the power to force these states to turn over the supplies and the manpower that were necessary to take on the world's greatest superpower. I mean, you look back on it, Jeff, it's almost amazing. It is amazing that we triumphed in that war, because it was really a war by committee, a war by voluntary contributions, and it was a close call. Hamilton and Washington, want to avoid this in the future. Again, we had won our independence, perhaps by the skin of our teeth, but now we're in danger of losing the peace. And this newly proposed constitution would allow this central government to some extent to get the kind of funding and to maintain the kind of military strength that would allow this newly independent nation to survive in a world of hostile powers. So never underestimate, I think this is an important lesson for folks listening, the extent to which that Revolutionary War experience and Hamilton's commitment to national defense or national security sort of undergirds the entire contributions in the Federalist Papers.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
As you mentioned, the Federalist seems to shift in about Federalist 37, 38 to then a kind of defense of the new Constitution. And Madison takes a big role, as you already mentioned, in sort of outlining what that means for separation of powers and for the legislative branch. But then, of course, we have some of the most famous essays happen when we get Alexander Hamilton coming back in defense of Article 2 of the Constitution and the executive.
Yeah. I've argued, Jeff, both to students in the MAG program and elsewhere, that even though Hamilton never served as president of the United States, His contributions to the office of the presidency, for better or for worse, are up there with some of our more significant presidents. So Hamilton begins, I think, in Federalist 68, basically saying, and this is where he takes a direct shot at Governor George Clinton, that the newly proposed chief executive will have powers that are even less worrisome or less assertive than the powers already possessed by the governor of New York. But from there, he proceeds to lay out his vision of what he calls an energetic executive. And an energetic executive possesses the ability to move, as Hamilton puts it, with decision, secrecy, and dispatch. And in particular, here we are back again in a sort of national security arena. Particularly, the president may need to respond to some type of foreign attack or some type of domestic insurrection and needs to move quickly and needs to possess even at times the independence to move quickly without any congressional authorization. So decision, activity, secrecy, dispatch, those are the characteristics that Hamilton foresees under the presidency created by Article II. And then he says, in order to ensure that that happens, you have to give the president various competent powers, including the veto, the pardon power, the commander-in-chief power. You have to give him a lengthy enough duration in office. Hamilton, again, wanted a president elected for life, but he was willing to accept 4 years with unlimited re-eligibility. You have to make sure the president is one person. You know, he spends a lot of time. Go ahead, Jeff. Did you want to please?
Yeah, no, I was going to raise that question because you had anti-federalists at the time, especially perhaps in New York, saying, the famous anti-federalist phrase was Article II creates the fetus of monarchy. And we can't have a republic if we're going to have a strong executive. And it seems to me that in Federalist 70, Hamilton actually flips that.
He does.
And says, if you want a successful republic, you have to have an energetic executive. But at the time, a lot of people thought, well, we ought to have executive of three presidents or some kind of president with an executive council or something. As you know, those were popular suggestions outside the convention and even in the convention. What's Hamilton's argument against that in favor of what has come famously one president?
Yeah. So Hamilton's argument, again, I think, Jeff, primarily goes back to the idea that this one executive will be responsible for any decisions that are made. And if he does abuse their power, you know who to hold responsible and you can impeach this person if need be. But perhaps more importantly, again, for Hamilton, it's the idea that the president will take care that the laws be faithfully executed. And he and many of his fellow Federalists have the memory of Shays' Rebellion, whether they overstated it or not. That incident in Massachusetts in 1786 scared the heck out of a lot of folks, including Madison, Hamilton, and Washington, when it appeared that Massachusetts as a state was unable to quell this uprising and perhaps it would spread. That, Hamilton argues, would not happen under this strengthened Constitution, with a president in charge of taking care that the laws be faithfully executed. The president would protect the rule of law, would protect the rights of property, which, by the way, later are going to get Hamilton in trouble with a lot of progressives who thought his emphasis on property was overstated. But nonetheless, that's the core of Hamilton's argument. One person is going to be responsible. That one person can move quickly to enforce the rule of law, and the rule of law needs to be enforced if Republican government is going to survive. And in Hamilton's view, the Articles of Confederation were not up to sustaining, in a sense, the rule of law.
It does seem to me that he operates, as he says, way back in Federalist Number 9, sort of what has been the downfall of republics historically. And it's either been one of two things, either internal faction, lawlessness and division, or externally, republics get swallowed up by empires. And it seems as you're outlaying out Federalist 70 and those essays defending the executive, he almost has those ideas in mind. when he's defending Article II.
I think so, Jeff. I mean, this is an important point. Hamilton did, and this perhaps I think does distinguish him from Jefferson and some of the Jeffersonians. Hamilton does have a somewhat dark view of human nature. Hamilton's reading of history arguably was very much Old Testament as opposed to New Testament. Man is very much a deeply fallen creature and is capable of rapacious, violent conduct. And the thing, as you said, Jeff, his reading of history as opposed to theology, his reading of history was that Republicans are frequently consumed from within. And again, this chief executive needs to be on guard against this type of domestic turbulence that can very easily spiral out of control. And it's Hamilton's hope was, and I'm not sure we're there anymore, but his hope was a president would take that law enforcement responsibility as one of his primary duties, and not obedience to public opinion or attempting to craft or manipulate public opinion. So that's what Hamilton's about, Jeff.
Yeah, can you say a little bit more about that? Because I am struck by, in those essays of Hamilton on the executive, he sometimes alludes to it explicitly, but often there's a kind of implicit understanding of the kind of character, the kind of human being that he envisions will be and should be president.
Yes.
What kind of a human being is he thinking about?
He's thinking about, Jeff, the best and the brightest. He's well aware there is the potential for somebody reaching the top, reaching the presidency, who's not necessarily of great character. But, and this is, I hope this addresses your question, Hamilton believed the Electoral College was one of the greatest innovations of the Constitution. And he makes that case in these Federalist Papers that we're discussing. And that Electoral College was hopefully, more often than not, perhaps not always, but more often than not, going to pick those individuals of high character, going to pick those individuals of national, perhaps even international stature. Those electors who would choose the American president would know of these national characters who are people of integrity and talent and who had the virtues necessary to govern a republic. That was his check against the possibility of a demagogue, of somebody coming to power with ill intent. That's where you were going to try to weed that out. Unfortunately, as we all know, the Electoral College no longer serves that purpose. But for Hamilton, that was quite a positive innovation. It was going to ensure that the chief executive did not abuse his power more often than not.
The rest of those essays, I'm thinking Federalist 73, 74, 75, 76, he lays out the president, what you already described as competent powers. He says the executive has to have competent powers, and under this Constitution, he has it. And he gives a very nuanced presentation, at least in my opinion, of the powers, some of which the president has by himself, commander-in-chief, the pardon power, and some the president shares with bodies like the Senate. Can you say a little bit more for our listeners about Hamilton's articulation of the president's powers?
Sure. So Hamilton, who's seen as somebody who, and I think rightly so, favored a certain amount of discretion for the chief executive, particularly if the United States were to be attacked. Hamilton viewed a declaration of war as something of a formality. Once that first American soldier is wounded or killed, the war has begun, and the president has the right, has an obligation to respond right then and there. But he does see a role for the United States Senate in the broader context of foreign affairs and arguably war powers. He sees less of a role for the House, although he does acknowledge the House has the power to declare war. But with that said, Hamilton viewed the Senate as something of a partner. Again, within this national security or defense foreign policy arena that Hamilton is very much focused on, he hoped that the United States Senate would also be composed, more often than not, of those individuals who were, to some extent, perhaps community leaders, the best and the brightest, They had a reputation within their particular states that would warrant them being elevated to a position of the United States Senate. And of course, these senators were going to be elected by the state legislatures, not directly by the people. So again, you have a kind of filtering of democracy that Hamilton favored. You and I would be able to vote for our state representatives. They in turn would select these members of the United States Senate, who again, hopefully had a somewhat broader, less parochial, more national, maybe even international outlook. And those individuals would work in concert with the president on things like treaty ratification and the appointment of key cabinet officers, secretaries of state, of war, et cetera, who would be involved in foreign and defense policy.
When he finishes the section on the executive, of course, as you mentioned, the next part is essays on the judiciary.
Yes.
Thinking of, for example, Federalist 78, which has become one of the most famous, certainly of the Federalist. And he has to defend something, Article 3 of the Constitution, that didn't really exist under the Articles of Confederation, which is a federal judiciary with judges appointed during good behavior. The anti-federalists, as you know, and as our listeners know, made hay out of this and said the Supreme Court will be exalted above every power in the United States and above the people and even God himself. Hamilton was a lawyer, understood the legal practice, understood the Anglo-American tradition of jurisprudence. What do you take from his defense of the federal judiciary?
Yeah, this arguably, Jeff, is perhaps where Hamilton's projecting ahead was maybe the least accurate of all of his projections. Now, in fairness to him, perhaps he should have seen the rise of progressivism and those who embraced the idea of a kind of activist judiciary. Nonetheless, Hamilton believed that giving these judges lifetime appointments dependent on good behavior, important point, and due to the nature of the legal practice, the legal world, the fact that one had to immerse oneself in, you know, a body of precedent, produced a certain kind of individual who would almost read those texts in a somewhat biblical fashion, that they would remain true to precedent. But the law itself, again, creates a kind of culture that is averse to experimentation, averse to radical change, inclined to protect the rights of property, for instance. That was his expectation. And he felt that, again, the worst thing one could do with the judiciary was have them democratically elected. That would produce a judicial appointee who is perhaps more in tune with public opinion. Public opinion is not what these judges are supposed to be interpreting when they engage in judicial review. It's the law, and in particular, the supreme law of the land, which is the United States Constitution. These judges, Hamilton hoped, would defend the Constitution against state and against other sort of, against any sort of populist attempts to undermine the rule of law. Again, I acknowledge, Jeff, that I think some of Hamilton's critics, both then in the anti-federalist camp and perhaps even today, have a point that Hamilton perhaps had an excessively rosy view of the role of the federalist judiciary. I'll leave it at that for now, but you can follow up.
Sure. No. That's it. That's fair. That's very interesting, because I'm thinking of the other criticism, and I'm going to let you have a chance to defend Hamilton on this a little bit, which is, I'm thinking of, there's 85 Federalist essays. Now, Federalist number 84 is particularly interesting, written by Hamilton at the end.
Yeah.
And he was, people who had the luxury of hindsight looking back have been fairly ferocious in their criticism of him for arguing in Federalist 84, we don't need a Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
It's unnecessary and perhaps even dangerous.
Yeah.
And it's a bit ironic now, because, of course, if you ask most people, name me something from the Constitution, they'll almost always tell you something from the Bill of Rights,
right.
Not from the original Constitution itself.
Yeah.
What's Hamilton's argument about the Constitution's lack of a Bill of Rights?
Sure. So again, a great question. And could I add just, Jeff, in response to you, Hamilton felt the judiciary would be, quote, the least dangerous branch. So
that's right. He did say that, didn't he?
He did say that in the Federalist Papers. As far as the Bill of Rights, actually, both he and Madison, now, this is often forgotten. Madison himself, along with Hamilton, for similar reasons, opposed the addition of a Bill of Rights. They both ultimately come around to realize this Constitution is not going to get ratified by some pretty important states without the addition of a Bill of Rights. So they will make that concession. But the argument was that the existing Constitution, without the addition of a Bill of Rights, was actually a Bill of Rights in itself.
Can you explain that argument to our listeners? Because that seems to be an argument that has been in some ways, unfortunately, lost today.
Yeah, I think it has been lost. But to a great extent, the fact that there were separation of powers, the fact that there were checks and balances, the fact that all sorts of federal appointees could be impeached, all of these things, and the fact that you had a written constitution with enumerated powers, all of these things were limitations on federal power and seemed to suggest that states and localities would maintain the sort of police power, if you will, not the federal government. Now, and the other key point, particularly for Hamilton, Jeff, if you begin to list those particular rights that are protected, what if you leave something off that list? And is it truly humanly possible to have a list of every single right that deserves protection? Now, I think some of Hamilton's critics would say he was being somewhat disingenuous. Perhaps he was. But that's the argument he makes in the primary argument that he makes in the Federalist Papers. You cannot have a complete and perfect specification of every protected right. And once you go down that path and write that, then you run the risk that some perhaps ill-inclined federal executive, the chief executive and a Congress that he might control, will begin to exploit those loopholes. I think that was the core of the opposition to a written Bill of Rights.
I'm struck by the tone, interestingly, after that discussion of the Bill of Rights in Federalist 84, the last essay, Federalist 85. In the general tone of Hamilton's writing in The Federalist, he's known as, of course, politically, as a sharp opponent, a person who is willing to attack where he thinks it's necessary, a person who does not often pull punches. Yeah. But there is a kind of exhortative tone to the people of the state of New York. Think about what you're doing. Think about how important this is. So much depends on this. I'm not sure I'd describe it as pleading, but as exhorting as to one's fellow citizens. Can you say a little bit more about the general tone of Hamilton's writing in The Federalist?
Yeah, I do think, Jeff, that Hamilton felt that the eyes of the world were upon us. He doesn't say that. He's not quoting John Winthrop. But there's an implication there, both in Federalist 1 and in Federalist 85, that if this experiment fails, and it goes back to what you opened our conversation with, the quote about, that this country truly was the last best hope for reflection and choice as opposed to accident and force prevailing in the affairs of men. And, I think, again, this is a man who often avoids a sort of poetry, to use that term loosely, a kind of poetry. But there is a romantic streak in Hamilton that comes out in number one, comes out in number 85. And again, I think he would agree with Abraham Lincoln that this country is the last best hope of mankind. And the American people in 1788 had a really rare choice to make, and one that would resonate through the centuries. Hamilton understood what was at stake. And, again, from my perspective, God bless him for throwing everything he had into this, even though, by the way, Jeff, he did have some quarrels with some of the particulars in the Constitution. Nobody fought harder for this Constitution than Alexander Hamilton.
When our listeners and their friends, their students are reading The Federalist and they're reading Hamilton's essays in The Federalist, what's the most important thing that they need to remember?
Yeah, I would say, Jeff, from my perspective, the most important thing I think that they need to remember is we all have a civic duty as citizens to understand what I just spoke about, which is that, and I believe this, I think Hamilton did, that our nation is something of the last best hope. If self-government, if Republican government fails here, I think the consequences for not only ourselves, but for the world are quite dire. I would add to that, Jeff, perhaps particularly in our time, Hamilton begins and ends the Federalist Papers warning of demagogues, warning of those leaders who appeal perhaps to our base passions, appeal to our hatreds, appeal to our fears, who have a tendency to single out perhaps unpopular groups. That this government, noble creation that Hamilton helped to create is something of a rarity. It can be lost in part through the efforts of demagogues who again appeal to our fears. And I would hope that my fellow citizens who are listening today would follow our better angels, to borrow from Lincoln, and help to sustain this truly rare form of government that we should all cherish.
Well, those are important words for us all to remember. Steve, thank you very much for being with us. To our listeners, don't forget Professor Stephen Knott's book, Coming to Terms with John F. Kennedy, a terrific analysis and memoir, and looking forward to your new book about presidents and conspiracy theories. Steve, thanks for being with us today on The American Idea.
Thank you, Jeff. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.